From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield. After more than a year of war and occupation, Iraq on Wednesday was to regain its sovereignty, a ceremony whose historical and political significance is debatable, but whose headline value is unquestioned. Thus did the 24-hour news channels and major broadcast networks start airlifting anchors, designing logos, and generally preparing for a major, major photo op. But then the unthinkable happened. Security concerns prompted the powers that be to make the switch 2 days early, before the networks could even cue the theme music. CBS was the first of the broadcast Big Three to get the story on the air, but not before a mad scramble.
CBS is getting details in Baghdad from our correspondent, Dan Rather.
One of the questions is going to be, well, why didn't they broadcast this live in radio and television? Why wasn't the public allowed to see it? And the answer, which has not been given officially, but is obvious, that for security reasons, they did it in this manner, including moving up the schedule.
Joining me now is CBS's Senior Vice President for News Coverage, Marcy McGinnis. Marcy, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob. Great to be here.
So Monday, kind of like spending 6 months planning an expensive wedding only to have the couple elope?
A little bit. More like the wedding that you had to plan really quickly because they decided to do it 2 days early.
Well, tell me what CBS and you had done in preparation for what was going to be the handover on Wednesday.
Well, we had sent our anchor, Dan Rather, over there. He got there Saturday, and we had our people on the ground shooting some material that would then turn into pieces for the various broadcasts that we do.
Graphic artists hard at work coming up with logos for over the anchor's shoulder and stuff like that as well?
Sure, all of that. And also just general reporting pieces, you know, what does it all mean, what to expect, that sort of thing.
So it was a big production.
It was a lot of preparation.
And on Monday at about 2:30 in the morning,
My phone rang. I was deep asleep. And the producer of our overnight broadcast said to me, The handover's happened. I said, what do you mean it happened? And he said, it already happened. And Dan's on our air right now. It was 2:30. He had broken the story on radio, and then he called up to the minute, and he was breaking the story on television. And so I said to the producer, okay, finish the sentence that you're talking to him, and then turn it into a special report, which means he was on the air with the stations that were taking the overnight broadcast at the time, and I wanted him to go to all stations.
So I need for you to be absolutely candid with me here. What percentage of your being at 2:30 in the morning is saying, oh, this is wonderful, it's unexpected, it's therefore news, and I'm all for news? And what part of you was saying, damn it to hell after all we went through?
You know what? If news happens, I'm not kidding, when it's happening, it doesn't matter if it's happening at 2:30 in the morning or if it's happening on schedule at 11 a.m. on Wednesday. All I was thinking at that time was, oh, my God, I have to get up, get dressed, and get in there. I wasn't really thinking in terms of, oh, no. I was thinking of, oh, my God.
Let me ask you about Dan Rather. You know, he heads over to Baghdad for this historic handover of sovereignty. And here this event occurs, and, you know, Dan is all dressed up, no place to go. He's not in the room. He can't report live. He has to wait till it's all over and to pick up the pieces. How frustrated was he?
Well, he wasn't frustrated at all because we, frankly, never knew if he was going to get into the ceremony anyway. We never knew, in fact, if there was going to be a ceremony. So on that morning, when his team got a call that said, bring a camera and whoever you want to this location, you can't bring your cell phones, our people said, uh-oh, something's going on. We don't know what it is, but we better be able to report this if it does happen. And if we can't bring cell phones, then we better figure out some kind of communication, and we better keep Dan at the location where he can actually broadcast. So we devised a system, which I don't want to say how we did it, where our people that were inside, the cameraman and the producer, were able to get the information out to Dan, who then was at our broadcast location, so that's how he was able to get on the air. So at 2:30, when he broke the story, he was totally pumped, and the stories that he had shot for Wednesday, you know, we moved him up to Monday, and the early show revamped its broadcast to accommodate the handover ceremony. So it really didn't affect much of the planning that we had done ahead of time. It just made us scramble.
Yeah, well, scrambling's fun.
Yeah,
adrenaline
is fun.
It is fun,
especially 3 o'clock in the morning.
I have to tell you, I took a sort of smug satisfaction in what happened because it's my feeling that there is, especially in this era of 24-hour news channels, both on cable and in the broadcast networks, a kind of theatricality that has been imposed on major news events with all the graphics and the specially composed music and the, you know, the logos given to to wars and so forth, that somehow ultimately trivializes the underlying news. So, you know, I kind of smirked when this all happened, I'm embarrassed to tell you. Do you have any sympathy for my smirkitude?
I understand your smirkitude. And I would only say that we as a network, and I think we are different from the cable networks, who do have to stay on the air for 24 hours and have a lot of airtime to fill. We are in the television business. We are in the visual business. So you do have to, you know, make some decent-looking graphics because the viewer is used to it. If you were still doing black-and-white TV with, you know, very not modern graphics, nobody would be watching. So in that sense, I don't make any apologies for doing nice graphics and maybe to have some opening animation that kind of captures the eye. I think the real reason we're there, though, is to bring perspective to the news that we're trying to report. So, in other words, the sovereignty is handed over, fine. There's the ceremony. Now let us try to provide a little bit of perspective as to what it means and what it means for our particular viewers.
All right, Marcy. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Marcy McGinnis is Senior VP for News Coverage at CBS News. Hanna Alam is Baghdad Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Her news organization was in attendance for the handover amid confusion, misdirection, and some conspicuous absences, notably the pan-Arab satellite channels Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya.
Yes, what struck me was I didn't notice a large presence of Arab reporters either at the government center or later that day. In fact, I had been at the government center all day long, finally got off, went to a restaurant here in Baghdad, and at that time there was a swearing-in ceremony for the new government, and I was watching with a restaurant full of Iraqis who were just hearing the news that the occupation was over for the first time at 3 p.m. when the actual ceremony occurred at around 10 in the morning.
I want to ask you a what-if question. Much of the imagery from the war and the occupation has genuinely been indelible. The statue of Saddam being toppled, Saddam getting his teeth checked after he was captured, and Linnie England clowning in front of abused prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison. Do you think that had the ceremony taken place as had been planned, that the images coming from it would have had that kind of enduring resonance, or do you think that they would have just been dismissed by Iraqis as just another stage-managed moment by the Americans as they hand over the reins to a puppet regime?
Well, many Iraqis have described this as not being the historic moment that many in the U.S. administration have described this. I mean, this is a country with a very, very long history of takeovers and regime changes, and to them this was sort of a blip in a timeline that extends thousands of years. I mean, obviously the images of Ambassador Bremer as he got on a military plane and prepared to leave the country, you know, were welcomed by Iraqis. At the same time, they were very quickly replaced by images of continued U.S. airstrikes in Fallujah and the hospital scenes of children and women in bloodied clothes. And those were really the images that are played ad nauseum on Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera and other pan-Arab satellite stations.
So what I'm asking is, as a lost media opportunity, probably not that big a one after all?
Probably not.
I want to talk to you about the events on Thursday, Saddam Hussein appearing before an Iraqi court to face charges of war crimes, among others. It's been getting wall-to-wall coverage on the 24-hour news cable stations in the United States. What's happening in the Arab world?
It was a huge story. People here were glued to their TVs when there was electricity. There have been a lot of talking heads on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, and they have focused on sort of attacking the foundation of the tribunal itself, you know, whether these people were appointed by Americans and how equipped they were to offer a fair trial for Saddam Hussein. At the same time, if we're talking about missed media opportunities, the U.S.-funded Iraqi satellite channel, Al-Iraqiya, I turned it on thinking that this channel, of all channels, would certainly have major Saddam coverage. And the time of the evening newscast, they actually were broadcasting a woman in a glittering evening gown introducing a band. It was some sort of variety show. One thing I found interesting was that, unlike CNN and the BBC, who focus solely on Saddam, Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera in particular gave equal coverage to the other former regime members whose names are much more known here in the Arab world. People were just as interested to see what Tariq Aziz had to say, for example, and one of these other 11 former regime members. I remember Al Jazeera, you know, they focused on him cracking his knuckles in court. That kind of detail you didn't see on CNN or BBC.
Like Captain Queeg with the steel balls in his hands as he falls apart on the witness stand. Very cinematic.
Absolutely.
These men in Saddam's regime and Saddam himself were feared and loathed for a couple of decades, and now they're in the dock as a result of this vastly unpopular war and occupation. And I'm curious if you're detecting in the media any ambivalence now about the occupation and war that is so universally despised as well.
You know, that seems to be a fact that escapes a lot of the commentators that I've seen on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Both networks have done a good job documenting the abuses suffered under Saddam Hussein by the Iraqi people. And now they're playing the trial big, but the sort of event in between is this unpopular war. And there's no question as to how that was received in the Arab world. People say, you know, we're happy that Saddam Hussein is gone, but that's no excuse for a prolonged occupation and for what many view as what will be the carving up of the Middle East.
Hannah, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Hannah Alam is Baghdad bureau chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Coming up, Russian journalists appear to be losing the battle against the mafia. Oh, and also there's porn. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In a 5-4 decision on Tuesday, the Supreme Court ruled that the Child Online Protection Act, or COPPA, probably violates the First Amendment, and the justices sent the case back to a lower court. This is the latest in an ongoing conflict between free speech and parental peace of mind, a conflict that has seen various legislative solutions sent back to the drawing board. Professor Jonathan Zittrain is the co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. He says that the COPPA law, deemed excessive by the high court, at least had honorable intentions.
The act is one of a series of acts that Congress has worked on starting in 1995. Designed primarily to keep material that could be harmful to minors, basically indecent material, off the World Wide Web to the extent that minors could see it.
Which is probably not something that a whole lot of people object to per se. Nobody wants young children to be exposed to smut.
The courts have always granted that this is a compelling government interest to keep kids away from pornography. And what that has translated to in this round of the litigation has been to ask the question, is there a lesser restrictive alternative? Is there something else Congress could have done to achieve this admittedly compelling end that does not burden adults getting constitutionally protected access to the very same speech?
And the court ruled a couple of things. Number one, that COPPA was an excessive breach of the First Amendment, but also that it was a kind of ineffectual way of going about keeping kids away from porn.
The idea was that if somebody putting information onto the internet puts out something harmful to children and kids get to it, it would be a felony. But then you can raise a defense, and one of the defenses the act talks about is that you checked for the existence of a credit card on the other side of the transaction. And that gets you off the hook once you raise it as a defense.
The court suggested, for example, that internet filters would be far more effective in blocking especially content from outside of the country whose purveyors are not subject to the credit card mechanism that is cited in the law.
Yes, the court makes a fairly subtle technological distinction here by saying that they understand that you could try to block the connection between kids and this material either at the source, asking the source to take on certain burdens, which might entail the source just saying, well, I'm not even going to provide this anymore. Or you could say, wait a minute, how about if we try to block it closer to the destination? And what the court mostly had in mind and what has been pressed in the case has been that you could install filters as a parent upon your PC. There are ways to encourage libraries and schools to put filters of a similar nature on their PCs. And through those filters, kids can not get access to this stuff, and the suppliers can still, without really any burden, put it onto the internet. That was thought to be the less restrictive alternative.
Under the category of unintended consequences, you said there were risks to this ruling because of its suggestion that filters are a better mechanism than criminal statutes for keeping certain material out of certain people's hands.
Yes, filters are certainly not a panacea, and even their most enthusiastic supporters tend to acknowledge that these filters will block out stuff that they really shouldn't be blocking and just accidentally or overbroad, and at the same time will let things through that they wouldn't have intended to let through. But even more worrisome than overblocking and underblocking is the fact that filters implemented at the level of simply a PC can fairly readily be ported vertically up to the internet service provider, and in certain government situations, right up to the level of the government to block material from an entire populace. Saudi Arabia, for example, has used SmartFilter. It's a filtering product that parents can use in the States, and Saudi Arabia uses for virtually every internet connection in the kingdom. It's that double-edged sword that it would be nice to avoid. If there were some way to develop the technology precisely to go after the problem of kids and pornography and implementing it PC by PC, that would be great, but there are clearly larger issues where we've seen this technology just embraced at the governmental level to filter out information deemed subversive or even just controversial.
All right. Well, Jonathan, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Harvard Law School Assistant Professor Jonathan Zittrain is co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. In April of 2002, in the Russian city Tolyatti, a newspaper editor was shot to death in his car. Valery Ivanov was murdered following a series of stories in the Tolyatti Observer exposing ties among the local mafia, businesses, and corrupt law enforcement agencies in the region. Although shocking, the assassination wasn't necessarily out of the ordinary. Ivanov was the sixth journalist targeted in Tolyatti since 1995. Killings documented in the film The Russian Newspaper Murders, to air as part of the PBS Wide Angles series this week. Director Paul Jenkins originally planned to focus on the Ivanov murder, but by the time he had raised money for filming, the new editor of the Tolyatti Observer, Alexei Sidorov, had become victim number seven, stabbed to death on his own doorstep. Predictably, Jenkins tells us, the local authorities leaped into action by arresting an innocent man.
Within a matter of days, the local police found a factory worker who they say committed the crime as a kind of act of street hooliganism. And it seems to me that the only evidence they have against that man is his own confession to the police. His family told us that he'd been beaten up in the police cells. In fact, the police refused to have a medical examination of the suspect immediately after he gave his confession. So, you know, the business seems very murky indeed.
An astonishing portion of your film is devoted to a man named Karin Narcissian, who was a lawyer brought in to investigate the investigation. And he faces an amazing array of bureaucratic obstacles.
The Glasnost Defense Foundation, which is a Russian charity representing the interests of journalists, paid for Nasution to go down and represent the families of the two murdered editors. We filmed him over a period of 3 days, and we just got remarkable evidence. And I think for Nasution, we were useful because our camera gave him a chance to actually record the testimony that he was unlocking as he went around the town. The case where we took the two witnesses, giving the guy who's currently on trial an alibi, when we brought those witnesses, or rather Nasution brought those witnesses down to the local head of investigation into the murder, and he refused to see those two witnesses, to even talk to them for 5 minutes, we were actually secretly recording at that stage. It would be naive to think that sometimes there aren't very powerful interests involved in some of these murders. And it seemed to me, certainly, that we were into quite serious business.
Were you at risk and your crew?
I went back to Moscow after 3 days with two tapes that had the alibi, that, you know, the witnesses for the alibi. And, you know, I thought, this is pretty hot stuff. I think I better get this down to the BBC office, get it copied and get it out of the country. Well, as we're driving down the road to the BBC office, my vehicle's rammed from behind on a six-lane highway. You know, and it's one of those things where you never know, you know, is it an accident? You know, is it a setup? Quite what's going on, you know? You don't want to be kind of Walter Mitty-esque about this, but on the other hand, no one's under any illusions on how dangerous it is to name names in criminal, industrial, political corruption.
One of the most depressing aspects of this film is that after the murder of two editors, number three, the third editor, who came from the finance department of the newspaper, takes over and backs away from the very investigative reporting that had gotten these journalists in trouble.
Yeah. I actually met the editor about a week after the murder of Sidorov. And, you know, he told me privately, I'm going to scale down the criminal coverage of the newspaper. But his problem was he couldn't tell his staff that because, you know, you have a committed corpus of journalists who are very passionate about what they do. And, you know, if the new editor comes and says, we're going to change the way we do business around here, you'd have a mutiny on your hands.
Well, if I'm in the Toyota Mafia, I say to myself, well, job well done. You have succeeded.
Yeah, it's depressing, isn't it? I mean, the fact is that in Russia, you can commission a murder very cheaply, and you can be almost certain that you'll never be caught.
If not the actual murders and the shoddy investigations thereof, maybe the most upsetting thing about this film is that the Toyota Review is almost alone in doing the kind of digging and asking the kind of questions and making the kind of accusations that it made, and that the rest of the Russian press you portray in your film as being just utterly quiescent and incurious and non-confrontational. How bad is it?
I think it's extremely serious. I think the basic problem is that the highest authorities in Russia don't really understand the value of a free media. Unfortunately, Russian traditions of leadership don't encourage a view that, in fact, the media can act as a really positive force in society. As Putin says, you know, Russia's never had a free media, so I don't see what I'm supposed to be impeding.
All right, Paul. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Paul Jenkins directed the Russian newspaper murders. It airs this week on the PBS series Wide Angle. Despite repeated warnings from Bush administration officials that terrorists could strike the United States on high-profile dates this summer, including this 4th of July weekend, most Americans have made more preparations for their barbecues than for a potential attack. In the first of a two-part series on civil readiness, OTM's John Solomon looks at how the administration is doing in its effort to market individual preparedness to the public and the press before another domestic terror attack.
Recent polls indicate that a majority of U.S. citizens expect the nation to be attacked by terrorists soon. Yet only a minority has followed the government's instructions to prepare for such an event. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge recently acknowledged an information gap between the government and its citizens when it comes to civil defense. That despite the department's Ready.gov awareness campaign, which was launched last February.
Every family in America should prepare itself for a terrorist attack.
The campaign includes a series of Ad Council PSAs featuring Secretary Ridge and emergency workers, which promote the Ready.gov website.
Terrorism forces us to make a choice. We can be afraid, or we can be ready.
The initial objective has been to convince people to assemble an emergency supply kit, develop a family communications plan, and generally become more informed about disaster preparedness. Department officials say Ready.gov has already had a considerable impact. In 1 year, the percentage of Americans who have done something to prepare went from 25 to 33%. The Ad Council calls Ready.gov one of its most successful launches ever, noting that PSA campaigns usually take years to produce significant results. Safety belt compliance, for example, took 20 years to move from 21 to 80%. But since most Americans don't expect terrorists to wait 20 years to strike, why are so many waiting to prepare?
I'll respond to your question as a working mom.
Susan Neely is the Homeland Security Department's Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs.
You know, we've got a lot on our plate, as particularly those of us who are parents. So I need a big, strong push to get me out there as an individual mom who's got two kids and a job and lots of things to do.
To provide a stronger push, Secretary Ridge has outsourced part of the readiness effort to America Prepared, a new nonprofit group under the leadership of Stephen Brill. It includes an unlikely assemblage of high-profile media figures. They span the political spectrum from Fahrenheit 9/11 producer Harvey Weinstein to Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. Last year, after Brill's book on Homeland Security was published, he suggested to Ridge that the Ready campaign could use some private sector adrenaline. Okay, the secretary agreed. Supply some.
Batteries, first aid kit, enough water for 3 days.
One of the first America Prepared PSAs features a young girl on monkey bars uttering some unexpected playground lingo.
A radio, a whistle, a dust mask, a plan.
By using kids to deliver the message, Brill hopes to make it socially unacceptable for adults to be too busy for civil defense.
The purpose of that ad, as with many of our others, is to capture people's attention, but to get them to understand that this is simple stuff. It's the kind of thing that you can do without upsetting your life, without, you know, changing the way you live.
However, focus groups said they needed not only the information, but also some practical help in putting it all together. So America Prepared created its own Ready emergency kit, complete with, yes, a roll of duct tape, and got Walmart to stock them. The group will concentrate most of its activities around September, which it says the Congress will declare National Preparedness Month. Brill has convinced a number of news organizations to do stories on readiness at that time. Secretary Ridge initially objected to September for fear it would be viewed as a political stunt. But Brill insisted that it was important to use the opening of schools to highlight family readiness planning and to take advantage of publicity tied to the anniversary of 9/11. Thus far, though media companies have donated more than $250 million in free ad time to Ready.gov, they have provided very little news coverage of civil defense. Homeland Security's Susan Neely.
It would help to have more straightforward media attention on not only the importance of emergency preparedness, but that it does make a difference. And if they could pay just a little bit more attention to highlighting the importance of emergency preparedness as a public service or as also part of the public information effort, I think would be very helpful.
Symbolically, the day Ready.gov launched, CNN interrupted an interview with a civil defense expert to go to a live helicopter shot of the attempted rescue of a dog in a river. The lack of press coverage may partly be the result of the Bush administration's reluctance to talk more specifically about the biological, chemical, or radiological terror threats, and what the public should do in the event of a major attack. It's a missed opportunity, according to Stephen Brill.
The way to educate people that, you know, a dirty bomb sounds a lot worse than it is, that most people would think, my God, it's a nuclear bomb and, you know, we're all wiped out. The way to calm people down about that and educate them about that is not a half hour after it happens with a hurried speech from the Oval Office. The way to do that is to do that in advance.
Homeland Security officials say they are trying to walk the fine line between informing people without alarming them or providing a roadmap for terrorists. And they point out that the Ready.gov site provides guidance on various terrorist scenarios. But even there, too much caution may be confusing to the public. Take Ready.gov's disclaimer. Quote, "We are not responsible if information that we make available on this site is not accurate, complete, or current. The materials on this site are provided for general information only, and any reliance upon the material found on this site will be at your own risk. The government's ambivalence about civil defense information became evident to journalist Richard Preston when he began reporting a nonfiction book on bioterrorism. The author of the best-selling The Hot Zone says that federal health and law enforcement officials encouraged him to write about this subject to sensitize the public to a looming threat. But almost none of them were willing to speak to him for attribution.
And so instead, I decided to turn it into fiction. And then when I began interviewing FBI people and so forth, they would say, oh, well, if you're writing a novel, well, let me tell you this and let me tell you that. And you would get a tremendous amount of information as long as the information is being poured into the pages of a novel.
So maybe it shouldn't be all that surprising that many Americans still don't accept as real the idea that they need to prepare. And as a result, unfortunately, the only truly effective civil defense marketing tool may be the next attack. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
Next week, the second part of the series on Homeland Security will examine the communications readiness of the government and the media in the event of a major terrorist strike. Up next, Michael Moore's shady dealings with the Carlyle Group. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. Matt Patton of Chicago wrote in to thank us for our discussion on CNN's lawsuit to gain access to Florida's felon list, which is likely to prevent some eligible Floridians from voting. Patton writes, I lived in Jacksonville 4 years ago when many people showed up at the polls to discover they were no longer registered to vote. It is a sad irony that in Florida, a state with its freedom of information protections written directly into its constitution, the public would be restricted from knowing who will be denied a vote in November. Matt, you'll be happy to know that on Thursday, a Florida state court judge ordered the Board of Elections to release the list. We had a strong response to our discussion about the apparent contradictions between the president's assertion that there were connections between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and the 9/11 Commission's declaration that there was no collaboration. Jeff Waldron of Amherst, Massachusetts, says he was, quote, very disappointed with our analysis. He writes, I thought that it was very clear that the inconsistencies in such reports, especially with regard to the ones by the press, the 9/11 Commission, and the White House, were a result of what they thought the words connection, collaborative connection, and relationship meant. For example, when OTM used the word connection, you instinctively considered it to mean a relationship in furtherance of terrorism. In contrast, the president purported it to mean a mere contact of suspicious character. At the very base of it, not all relationships are beneficial. After all, even the U.S. has a relationship with Osama bin Laden, doesn't it? But instead of a concise discussion of how we should understand the meaning of those words and how they are interpreted by different people, you spent your time belittling the perceptiveness of the news audience. I agree that the inferences by the White House have been terribly misleading and that they have made a mountain out of a molehill. I am bothered by how many people think that Iraq sponsored 9/11, but the media is all about the images and words we use, and to assume everyone hears them in the same way is foolish. You've rarely made that mistake, but I think you made it in this case. We appreciate the feedback. Keep it coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 took in $30 million in its first weekend, making it both a blockbuster and a bombshell. The hilarious and disturbing documentary attack on the Bush administration is the first theatrically released feature film explicitly conceived to influence a presidential election. And it may well succeed, portraying the president variously as clueless, impotent, heartless, and corrupt. But like previous Michael Moore films, Fahrenheit 9/11 is more polemic than journalism, picking and choosing facts and footage that serve the filmmaker's point of view and discarding facts that are inconvenient. It has thus come under the attack of so-called truth squads who take issue with how Moore takes issue with the government. Newsweek investigative correspondent Michael Isikoff is one of the skeptical, and he joins me now. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be with you.
Moore and his distributors, the Weinstein brothers, have made a point to say that they hired fact-checkers to vet every frame of the film.
Right.
How did they do?
Well, there are facts and there are facts. Most of the sort of specific points in the film will check out. What doesn't check out is the way they string them together to make larger points that viewers will see and think are true, and then walk out not realizing there really isn't any evidence to support the sort of larger point they're trying to make. I actually think it's a quite powerful movie that I think has a lot to say and, you know, will and ought to provoke a lot of discussion. But I do think some of the conspiratorial claims in the movie are over the top and not supported by the available evidence.
All commercial and airline traffic was grounded.
But we had some airplanes authorized at the highest levels of our government to pick up Osama bin Laden's family members and transport them out of this country.
Moore's interpretation is that 24 Saudis, including members of the bin Laden family, were spirited out of the country immediately after 9/11, presumably, at least we're led to believe, to shield them from investigation.
That is pretty much contradicted by what's in the findings of the 9/11 Commission. And they said, contrary to what some of the allegations were, that many of the Saudis were asked detailed questions, that the FBI screened them in other ways, including checking their names against terror databases, and concluded at the end of the day that none of them had any involvement in 9/11 or were needed for any further questions relating to the 9/11 investigation. But the probably most dishonest part of what Moore does in that passage is he hangs a lot on the claim that the White House approved these flights, suggesting that the White House did so because of its coziness with the Saudis, deriving from this supposed financial nexus between the Bush family and the House of Saud. Well, the problem is we know exactly who in the White House approved the flights, and it wasn't the president, it wasn't the vice president. It was Richard Clark, a holdover from the Clinton administration, who was then serving as counterterrorism czar and who has since become a fierce Bush critic.
Another provocative element in the film is the administration's pre-9/11 relationship with the Taliban.
Yeah, I think this is actually one of the more dishonest, if not the most dishonest, single thing in the movie. Moore leaves the implication that the Bush administration was soft on the Taliban in the months before 9/11 because it was interested in a pipeline deal that was being pushed by a big American oil company, Unocal. Well, it is true that Unocal was interested at one point in building a pipeline, a natural gas pipeline, through Afghanistan. And it is true that Unocal was pushing for that pipeline and even lobbying in Washington. They did so during the Clinton administration. And what the movie doesn't tell you is that in 1998, Unocal dropped out of the deal. So by the time George W. Bush takes office, there is no Unocal pipeline project on the table at all. There's no pipeline deal being discussed.
Moore doesn't claim to be a journalist. He says that he has a point of view to flog, and he's going to flog it.
Look, it's a free country. You can put out there anything you want. And, you know, God knows the political right threw out a lot of bogus charges about Bill Clinton in all sorts of different forms. And I think there's a certain feeling of political payback here on the part of somebody like Michael Moore on the left. But that doesn't absolve the rest of us from, you know, doing our jobs and pointing out, hey, this is true, this isn't, this goes too far. This movie is a huge cultural and political event. It's bringing access to issues in a different form that's reaching out to a lot of people who wouldn't normally be engaged by reading stories about these matters in the New York Times or Newsweek or some other publication.
I think there's probably a pretty big overlap between liberal values and journalistic values, a sense of suspicion of authority, skepticism, looking out for the little guy, and so forth. If you accept that proposition, do you think that they're inherent in a lot of the criticism of Moore's techniques? There's a sense of betrayal that someone with whom journalists are politically sympathetic, at least with respect to the Bush administration, is playing so fast and loose with the truth, essentially embracing the very tactics that the Bush administration is alleged to have employed to mislead us all?
Yeah, I quote in one of the stories from a former Clinton associate saying, I'd like to think my guys play by the rules and have higher standards. That's why they're my guys. And a feeling that when you see some of the innuendo and stretching the truth that goes on in the Moore movie, it's disheartening to people who really want this to be fought on a high, fair, and accurate plane.
Thank you very much for
joining us. All right, thanks.
Michael Isikoff is an investigative correspondent for Newsweek. One of Michael Moore's targets in Fahrenheit 9/11 is the Washington investment firm The Carlyle Group. And he's hardly the first to take aim. Never mind the Freemasons and the Trilateral Commission, the new millennium's unified theory of human events hinges on what one website calls a sinister, warmongering worldwide octopus. Other online critics have called it a shadowy, corrupt global network and the axis of corporate evil. Nor are the suspicions confined to the internet. The Washington Post, Vanity Fair, the LA Times, and The Guardian have written with raised eyebrows about Carlyle's ties to the Bush family and the Saudis. American Prospect called Carlyle, quote, nothing more than a gigantic corporate kickback. And The Economist summed it up tidily. The Carlyle Group, it wrote, is a godsend for conspiracists who are convinced the world is run by and on behalf of a shadowy network of wealthy men. All of which heated rhetoric drives the Carlyle Group nuts. Christopher Ullman is Vice President for Corporate Communications at Carlyle, and he joins me now. Chris, welcome to OTM.
Bob, it's good to be here. Thanks.
Well, it was very easy to Google Carlyle Group and come up with any number of, you know, fairly wild-eyed conspiracy theories at the center of which purportedly sat Carlyle. But it was a little more difficult to do that among legitimate news organizations.
If you go to Factiva or LexisNexis and type in Carlyle Group, you'll get articles by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and other respected publications that are, for the most part, focusing on our deal activity, things we buy and sell. But nonetheless, we've had a challenge even with the so-called legitimate press. For example, The Economist said that we were secretive and unapproachable, despite the fact that I had actually been in The Economist offices the week before the article was written, meeting with the New York bureau chief at my request and had a very constructive meeting. Le Monde, prominent French publication, said that they wanted to interview Carlyle. So we set up an interview, and then they wrote an article about us based on things they saw on the internet and then published it before the interview. And in it said that we were secretive, which was really pretty ironic, and said that you could not find out what companies we owned. But at Carlyle.com, we've got every company that we own on our website. So it really presents a challenge from a PR standpoint as to how do you overcome this kind of institutional bias by even legitimate news organizations.
But what are you doing to counter the rumor mongering that swirls around Carlyle Group?
We've engaged in a dramatic disclosure campaign. As I like to say, Glasnost has come to the Carlyle Group, and we've done a whole range of activities, everything from creating a state-of-the-art website. We've conducted literally hundreds of media interviews and get-to-know-you chats with media literally around the world in the past couple of years to get people to focus on what we do, which is invest money on behalf of primarily institutional investors. We buy companies, make them better, sell them, and make some money for our investors. It's as simple as that, at least in theory. In application, it's been more challenging.
You're not stupid. You know what it is about Carlyle that has raised so many eyebrows and so many suspicions over the years. What would you characterize as the fundamental problem from which all of this PR difficulty ensues?
It focuses on three things. One is that Carlyle made its name and early investment success in the defense sector, meaning we bought companies, defense contractors, and made them better and sold them. That's part one. Part two is that several, just a handful, around six or seven former senior government officials were affiliated with Carlyle, including former President Bush, Secretary of Defense Carlucci, former Secretary of State Baker, Arthur Levitt. And then third is that it was revealed after September 11th that a family member of the Bin Laden family was an investor in the Carlyle Group. Now, Osama, who's clearly the evil guy, has 54 half-siblings, and it was their family investment arm that had invested with us. So this was kind of a cosmic soup of information that the conspiracy theorists and even everyday folks found a little too delectable to ignore.
Your PR materials on Carlyle.com speak of the Carlyle Edge. Now, isn't the Carlyle Edge that it has access to, or at least leaves the perception of access to, the corridors of power?
Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of Defense, helps Carlyle. But the key is how he helps us versus how he does not help us. How he does help us is that he knows how the defense sector works. He knows people at defense contractors. He can call them up and say, hey, you have a subsidiary that is clearly your ugly stepchild and Carlyle would like to buy it. Are you interested? What he does not do is call up Donald Rumsfeld and say, hey, can you give company XYZ that we own extra contracts? The assumption is that because Donald Rumsfeld and Frank Carlucci know each other and wrestled together in 1952, that therefore the rules are all bent to benefit Carlyle.
Your own co-founder, Daniel Rubinstein, has been quoted as saying in the Washington Post that, quote, maybe you get this influence by people thinking you have it. Now, he seemed to have been saying that as a, sort of a frustrated aside, but it sure sounds like a business strategy. You don't have a giant private equity fund if you don't have people to invest in it. And if you're trotting around President Bush or James Baker, who, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't have any investment experience along with being a former Secretary of State and political strategist and campaign manager and lawyer, you certainly are inviting the intimation that there is some influence to be peddled, no? I mean, isn't there a structural problem that is at the very root of your image problems?
I disagree. We are very straightforward, both publicly and privately, about what each of these individuals does.
When you were hired 2.5 years ago, and they said, Chris, you know, it's driving us crazy how people think we're sinister and evil and corrupt influence peddlers. Did you say to them, well, you know, just look at your letterhead and the names attached to it. It's no freaking wonder?
Well put. I'm a PR guy who deals with the facts. And there are some very tangible facts that have led people to get all excited about the Carlyle Group. So it's clearly a creation to a great extent of our own making. But that doesn't excuse superficiality by either the media or the public. And we, you know, we beg patience and understanding of people too, knowing that for 14 years we did not communicate effectively, but that we have seen the light and see the virtue of improved disclosure and want people to go beyond just the sexy surface. It's easy and superficial to simply say they are shadowy and dark and part of a cabal that runs the world. But ultimately, scratch the surface, actually make a phone call, talk to me, and read real publications that have written real stories about our deals, and you'll find out that there's no there other than 300 investment professionals who know what a good deal is and how to execute it.
Well, Chris, thank you so much.
Bob, thanks for the opportunity, and have a good one.
Chris Ullman is Vice President for Corporate Communications for the Carlyle Group. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Volo and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Our managing editor is Brooke Gladstone, and she will be back next week. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.